puts me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
One day, Bruce is going to let me do an a cappella version of that song, and hopefully Gordon Goldsborough will join me in that version. Gordon?
No.
Come
No,
on.
No, no.
It's the least you can do. Gordon Goldsborough joins me now from the Manitoba Historical Society, not to sing, but to enlighten us about another abandoned Manitoba site. Good morning.
Good morning, Nadia.
Now, remind us from the clue. Remind us of the clue from last week.
I said that this week we would talk about an extensive area of wetlands in southeastern Manitoba that in the early 20th century was turned into one of the largest dairy farms in North America.
From wetlands to dairy farms, do tell.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like an obvious thing at all.
Or delicious, but continue.
Well, people may not know that, in fact, when settlers began to arrive in southern Manitoba, they found a huge area of wetlands, not just in southeastern Manitoba, but all over the southern part of the province. So one of the things that many of the early farmers did very diligently was to drain. In fact, for decades, even today, farmers still actively engage in drainage so as to make land that is otherwise too wet farmable. So one of the last areas to be drained, simply because when the first settlers arrived, they came to the area of southeastern Manitoba and went, ooh, too wet here, so they kept going. So by the time you get into the early 20th century, about the only land that is left, if you want to establish a farm, would be that area. So a fellow by the name of Watson Davidson, he was an American from St. Paul, Minnesota, he came here and wanted to establish a fairly large farm. The only area left was this area of southeastern Manitoba, and it was wet. So he thought, well, okay, this is a challenge. And so over the course of the next 20 or 30 years, he very diligently drained the land. In fact, that was one of the conditions of him getting the land, was that he had to improve it.
And at that point, what was the technology available to drain land?
Well, they used something called a walking dredge. People may have a vision of what a dredge is. It's sort of a floating device that scoops up mud off the bottoms of lakes and rivers. Well, this was a device that actually walked on the land, sort of land. Land was quite wet. Mm-hmm. And it would scoop out land and to actually make ditches. And so he had three of these walking dredges. Now, the reason you say, well, why does he need three of them is because the area that he was given was vast. Mm-hmm. It was over, by the time it reached its height, he had over 100,000 acres. Now, many people might not really realize how big an area that is. So, and another way of putting it is that's over 150 square miles.
Oh, wow.
You know, that is
substantial and a big amount of land to drain.
That's right. And that's why he had to put in such investment. In fact, it was said that over the course of his time there, he spent over $3 million, which, you know, today is still a large sum of money. But of course, this is 100 years ago. That was a vast amount of money. And he used that to say to not only to improve the land. So he did a lot of dredging. He apparently dredged over 120 miles of ditches. He also built roads because, of course, there wouldn't have been roads in this area otherwise. And of course, to get into various parts of the land, you would need roads. We built those. And then, of course, he built infrastructure. He built a farm.
He's responsible for a lot of investment into that land.
Absolutely. You know, even today, you know, people should be reminded that if you ever travel in this area, the area, by the way, if you're wanting to go visit, it's sort of in the area of Marchand, Manitoba, in the rural municipality of La Broquerie, about 40 miles southeast of Winnipeg. And today, you can, of course, travel along very nice roads. But if you look carefully, you'll see alongside a lot of these roads, there's a big soil berm, a big pile of soil, which, of course, is the soil they would have dug out of these ditches to make the ditches, and then they just piled it alongside. So even today, you can be reminded of all the work that he undertook.
Now, from your biology background, did this drainage have negative impacts on the environment?
Well, we are concerned, of course, today about drainage because it can have impacts. I mean, in some cases, it's actually desirable if you want to, for example, you know, get water out so you can make the land farmable. But of course, when you drain the water out, it can carry with it a lot of the associated chemicals. So if you have, for example, fertilizers that have been applied to farmland, if you have pesticides, you know, that a lot of that can be carried away in this runoff water. And of course, wetlands by their very nature are a very good place for chemical reactions to take place. And we always, for example, call wetlands, they are nature's kidneys. Mm. So in effect, by draining them, by turning them away from wetlands into farmland, you're basically destroying that sort of kidney function on the landscape. Mm-hmm. So today, in fact, there's sort of a mantra we're trying to present, which is keep water on the landscape. To some degree, at least, let these wetlands stay as wetlands so that we get some of the benefits that they provide us.
But not so much in 1920. Now, after he dredged the land, what happened next?
Well, he built dairy barns because he was going to establish a large dairy. And he built apparently 6 very large barns. He hired over 150 people. Now, these were people from the surrounding communities, but also because there just weren't enough people there, he would bring in immigrants. People from Hungary, from Poland, from Romania came and oftentimes would stay in the area after they had come to work for him. So in a way, he was almost responsible for a lot of the immigration to the area as well. So they had 150 workers. They had over 1,000 dairy cows. And now in the day, of course, it was dairying was a fairly labor-intensive process. Most dairies would have simply milked by hand. Well, he had machines. He had dairy milking machines that he would use to milk the cows. But of course, they need electricity to run. So in addition to everything else, he had a power plant on the site. Because of course, this area of Manitoba didn't have electricity until the 1950s. And we're talking about, you know, back 30 or 40 years before that. So he had, to say, a modern farm by all measures. It was, you know, quite an advanced farm for its day. So he had this major dairy operation, but he also had another farm about 12 miles away, and it was sort of a ranch operation, and he had a telephone system, a private telephone network, again, long before the area had phones otherwise, to keep all these barns in contact with one another. So, say, an incredibly sophisticated operation.
So what happened to these dairy farms?
Well, over time, things, of course, did change. Events had a bearing on the operation of this big dairy. For example, during the Great Depression, of course, because there was a lot of hardship, the dairy operation suffered a little bit. But what really had the biggest impact, I think, on the dairy was the Second World War. Because, of course, a lot of able-bodied men were recruited to serve in the military, men who would otherwise work at the dairy. So they had a real tough time operating the dairy during the Second World War. And I think that's probably as much as any the major contributing factor to the downfall of this dairy operation. They did switch to things like livestock operations. They would have ranching where they would grow beef cattle, for example, because they had this very large, you know, area that they hadn't had. So that was, you know, one way of at least of keeping the money coming in. But during the late 40s, after the war ended and into the 50s, it really did decline. And I think partly it was simply because Mr. Davidson was getting elderly. By this time, he was now in his 70s. He wasn't the vigorous fellow that he had been in his earlier years. And so by all accounts, one of the things that really contributed to it was his, you know, the loss of his leadership. He died in 1954. And so although the operation continued on, his sons, for example, operated it up until around 1970. It was just a shimmer of itself, what it had been in the past.
And then what happened to it after that?
Well, it was sold. The land was sold first to a fellow from South Dakota and who intended to turn it into a large ranch. Later to a doctor from Kansas. There was a fellow from Louisiana. You know, a series of Americans. And unfortunately, none of that really kept it vigorously going. So it kind of petered out at that point. And I think the land was parceled up and sold to various people. So today, the land is owned by a variety of farmers in the local area. Some of whom grow crops on that land. Some of them still do cattle operations. It's still a fairly active area for livestock, although of a different kind, not cattle anymore. There's an awful lot of hog barns in that area that have been built on this land that was drained by Mr. Davidson over 100 years ago.
Well, I was going to say, the legacy he left for other farmers to come and use that land.
Precisely. But there is an additional dimension to this whole story that fascinates me. In the 1920s, he put together what he called the Davidson Plan, which was packaged farms. Now, the idea was that a lot of land developers would simply sell you the land, then it was up to you to do something with it. You had to build the barn, build the house, and so on. His was a turnkey operation. In other words, you came, you had land, you had a house already to occupy, you had a barn with cattle already in it, you had a horse and wagon ready to go. It was literally, you could walk right in and become a farmer instantly. And that fascinates me because, of course, for some people anyway, that would have been incredibly appealing. So these Davidson farms were sold through the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And we still see evidence of them today. In fact, not long ago, I had an opportunity to visit this area of Manitoba. And there isn't a lot of evidence of the barn still standing. The original headquarters of that original huge dairy farm As far as I can tell, there's one barn remaining, and it's looking pretty sad. It's not in good condition. The generator, the place where they would have created electricity, is still there too. But the only other real tangible signs is that on these package farms, they would put a silo where you could store silage for your animals, and at least two of the sites, there are still these concrete silos still there. The rest of the buildings are gone, the barn, the house, and so on. So you drive by and you think, what's that big concrete silo, like with that big cylinder out in the field doing? Well, that's the remains of a former farm that was there in the 1920s.
There you go.
So there's our abandoned part of the story.
Thank you so much, Gordon. What clue do you have for us for next week?
Well, next week we're going to look at a community in eastern Manitoba that every Labor Day weekend celebrates a festival called the 4P Festival. Mm. But as a result of an abandonment, it seems to me they should probably rename it to the 3P Festival.
The mystery continues, Gordon. Thank you so much and happy birthday, because it is exactly 2 years since you first started doing Abandoned Manitoba.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
I will now sing happy birthday for you. Bruce is shaking his head, so we'll save that for next year. Gordon,
okay.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Nadja.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba, many moons.